All right, everybody, welcome back to Project JFK CSI Dallas Presents The Journey. This is our July 2024 meeting. It is 1:07 p.m. I'm your host, David Knight, with Project JFK CSI Dallas. And I want to welcome everybody back from the hiatus that we had since our last conference. We had an opportunity to put on a conference. This is our first meeting since then. So I want to tell you a little bit about what we did in April. We had done a conference, a student symposium is what we called it, trying to get the younger generation involved and to bring awareness to not only high school students, but especially college kids or college students. We brought in a large group of, presenters that came in on their own dime, paid for their own hotel room and their travel. And I want to reach out and thank each one of those people that had came in and gave their presentations. We had a nice outpouring. I wish we could have got a few more students in the room, but then again, we are talking about something from 61 years ago, and some of them may think that this is not, important, but I think over the last few months, especially what's going on politically in our landscape with the election this November, there are starting to be more younger people getting involved with what's going on in the world around them. And I can't think of a better place to start than going back to the 1960s to see what took place in the political landscape and the political assassinations that took place during that decade. I want to point out to the people on Zoom and also the people on YouTube that will be watching this once it's posted later this evening. You can go to Project JFK CSI Dallas, projectjfk.com. Let me get that website up here real quick. For all the events that are taking place, obviously the student symposium, I want to say real quick, obviously Project JFK, myself, Casey, Brian, but also David Denton, Larry Rivera, Doug Horn, Beverly Sadowski, Ryan Jones, Ed Tatro, and Mal Hyman were all part of our event. So I want to say thank you to our speakers. I want to say thank you to the audience in person and also those that joined us on Zoom. The videos are being worked on, so they will be available if you missed getting a chance to join us in person or join us in person or join us on Zoom, and you want to see those videos afterwards. They are getting processed. I'm working on basically three sets of videos right now: the Dallas 2023. Memphis 2023, and also the conference that we just finished in April. But if you like what we're doing and you see that you want to become a donating person and a backer for our cause, you can go to projectjfk.com, click on the homepage, go down to Help Our Cause, click the Donate button. It will take you to PayPal, and you can make a donation. Let me get rid of that. So if you like what we're doing, feel free to join us on that. In just a little bit, David Denton with the JFK Historical Group is going to be coming on, and he's going to be talking about the November in Dallas conference that we're going to be having. He's got some details for us, and if you're on the mailing list, I'm sure you've been getting some information about speakers. The schedule had just came out. So we're going to be talking about that as well. I don't want to let that out of the bag until he gets on, but I'll let him take that part away. Let's see here. Still letting people in the room. Hold on just a sec. There we go. Today we're going to have guest speakers of Larry Rivera. He's been doing some new updates. Hopefully they will appear on Zoom correctly, but he's taken the Blender model he's been working on, and he's now animated. He's made a lot of changes. I'm going to have him come on and do a short presentation later on. I think what he's working on is fundamental and it's important to our research to actually go back and have another key point of view by bringing in the information from the photographs, the assassination films, and to see them in a new light and maybe see things that, you know, we have in documents and in testimony that's supposed to be there, but we don't see those in the film. And one of the things that Larry's doing is taking that information and putting it into the Blender model, so that way we can maybe see what should be there that we're not seeing. So we're gonna have him talk, and then like I say, David Denton will come on. We have Larry Snaff in the room. Hi, Larry. I want to have Larry give us any updates that he has on the lawyer side of the case for the records and the documents. We haven't heard from you, Larry, since I think it was right before our conference when we had our last meeting.
If I may also interrupt also about that incident on YouTube where some posts that we did on the Mexico City tapes that came out were have been erased and censored, not by YouTube itself, but by the owner of the channel. And maybe in the next 4 hours, we can cover a little bit of that.
Yeah, we can definitely talk about that. And speaking of, you know, free speech, you know, I believe in free speech 100%. I don't believe in censoring, but in the same regards, when it comes to certain discussions, you have to understand when it comes to our YouTube channel, which is where this video will be posted later tonight, you know, comments are made by the general public, by the research community, and by some people that have no idea what the hell they're talking about because they're not informed. But again, they're entitled to their opinion. As long as, you know, I have not taken down any comments off of our YouTube channel unless it's a threatening manner. And granted, that can be a wide swath of what that kind of comment can be. But if it's a outright attack, what we call a weaponization of words or statements, then yeah, that can be taken down. And that's totally up to the person that's running that channel, whether it's our YouTube channel or anybody's YouTube channel. You know, it's up to that person's channel to, you know, police it. And maybe I don't want to use that word, but that's what it is. It's policing the information, whether it's the videos themselves or if it's in the comment section. So Larry will talk about that here in a little bit. But like I say, I want to hear from Larry Snaff. Larry, go ahead and unmute your mic and welcome back. How have things been going the last few months?
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you. I can see you.
Okay, great. Thank you. So I'm trying to remember. Well, I think the listeners know that Mary Farrell, we filed an interlocutory appeal to the Ninth Circuit. That is an appeal. Normally, you appeal at the end of the case after a judgment has been rendered. What we've done is we have appealed some of the orders issued by the court when we were asking for injunctive relief, asking for the court to order NARA to do certain things. The court denied those requests. So we have filed an appeal with the Ninth Circuit to review those orders. It's called an interlocutory appeal because it's while the case is still going on. They're very rare to win on, but we felt it was worth a shot. The government filed its answering brief with the usual responses that we anticipated. We have to respond. We'll be responding, I think, the second week in August, and then. Then the court will decide whether they want to hear our case. And they did indicate to us, so there's a possibility that this case could be heard in the fall. If the Ninth Circuit, we need to have they pick three judges, and two of the three judges have to agree to hear the case. Even if the Ninth Circuit decides that it doesn't want to hear the interlocutory appeal, it doesn't mean that we can't appeal at the end of the day when the case is over on district court level. But we're trying to get these orders that we think were wrongly issued, that we think they represent a misunderstanding of the statute, and also an interpretation is not advanced the goals of the statute. So if we win, then that would probably mean that we now have a chance to go back and have the court reconsider the arguments based on whatever instructions they get from the Ninth Circuit. And then while that's going on, we are preparing our discovery requests we actually made requests for discovery to take depositions of certain people in the government and former government officials, and that there's going to be a status conference with the judge to determine if the judge will allow us to make those, have those depositions, and if so, what the schedule would be. Normally in an administrative law case, which this is, it's usually hard to get discovery, but this is a unique case because, we're asking questions about how people did or didn't do things. So that should be, I think our status conference is in the process of being scheduled. It might be the first week in August. I do have a question. If anyone lives in Ohio, I've been going through the legislative history of the JFK Act, and there's been some interesting wrinkles that I was not aware of. Apparently, just for a little bit of background to support this request, when Congress, the House and the Senate, introduced bills in the spring of 92, the Department of Justice objected to the creation of the ARB in terms of who was going to appoint it. And there were conversations going on, and then John Glenn issued an amended statute, law, that was then voted on by the Senate in July of 92. that law, that bill, for the first time had this section on periodic review. So up until that point, the original bill provided that when the ARB went out of business, all the responsibilities would clearly become that NARA had the responsibility of reviewing the postponements made by the ARB, and they would be the sole agency that would make those decisions. Then this periodic review section was put in by the John Glenn amendments. And there's no discussion about those, what the purpose of that section was, because most of the debate was about how do you restructure the ARB. And they reached an agreement where, it would be, the ARB would be chosen by Congress and by the president. But this other section was snuck in. And then in the end of September of 92, there's the House substitutes this Senate bill for its own bill with no discussion. The only discussion on the floor of the House is that the only change is this change about how the ARB is going to be appointed. No discussion about the other changes in the statute. So I had Chad Nagel go to the National Archives to review the committee reports, the legislative history that was in the committee records, and there was nothing there that was illuminating. So what I would like to do, if there is someone that lives near where John Glenn's papers are, which is in Columbus, Ohio, if someone is living near Stokes, I think Stokes' papers are in Cleveland, and who's the third one? Anyway, those two are key right now. So if anyone lives in those areas, I would like please let me know, because I'd like to have maybe you go take a look at the John Glenn, for example, his papers. I've actually identified folders. I went through what was online. I actually have the boxes and the folders that have to be reviewed. Want to see if there's anything in John Glenn's papers or Stokes' papers that would shed light. There's also there was also a senator from Texas, from Oklahoma, Boren, and then there's Jack Brooks from Texas. So those are the four guys. They were the four key sponsors of the legislation. And I'd like to look at their personal papers to see if there's anything in there that's of significance. So if there's any listeners here that I don't know where Jack Brooks' papers are. I assume they're probably in Austin, but I'm not sure. And Boren was from Oklahoma. So if anyone lives within vicinity of where those papers are, they're usually put in probably in a library at some university. I don't know where Boren's is or Brooks are. But once we find out where they are, if anyone is located in those states that are within proximity to where the papers are, I'd like to talk to you about what to look for. And maybe you could help us with the legal research, because there's a big black hole in the statute as to how it went from the version that was subject to the public hearings and testimony in May to the final version that was signed into law in October. It looks like there was some shenanigans going on behind the scenes, because there's no explanation, at least in the public record, as to the reasons for the changes and what the purpose of those changes were. John Glenn had an oral, they made changes in the markup through an oral markup. There were no hearings. The committee got together and they made these changes. And then the House simply substituted that Senate bill for their bill with no, and the only discussions in the congressional record are there's no changes except for the way the ARB has been selected, which is not true. The statute was changed in many ways. So trying to get to the bottom of this so we can have some legislative history to explain to the court. That's the whole purpose of this. We want to try to get some legislators, some evidence if we can, if there's anything in the legislative record to show what the purpose of these changes were. So with that, David, I guess I'll turn it back to you.
All right, Larry. Well, is there anybody in our audience that can take on the fact of going for the records in up in Ohio? If so,
Larry, I live in San Antonio, Texas, about an hour from Austin. So if we can find out where Brooks was, if it's in San Antonio, Austin, Dallas area, let me know.
Okay. I see your email. Hold on a second. I got your email. Okay.
I sent my email and phone number to you, to the chat.
Okay, wait a second. Okay, you know what? While we're talking, I just want to take a quick look at my legislative history, because I want to find out there was one more guy I wanted to get. I think he was from Michigan, the representative. So that's great. We need someone from John Glenn. John Glenn was the chair of the Senate committee that, you know, sponsored the legislation. So his papers would really be important. So if anyone lives near Columbus, please let me know. Otherwise, I'm going to have to go out. You know, I don't know if I have enough time to go out there before we have to file our brief.
All right, Larry, does anybody have any questions about what Larry's discussed? And there are certain things that he can't speak of. Obviously, there's some of the case he can't discuss. But if there's somebody that has a question about what's going on with that, would anybody like to ask Larry here on the meeting?
Clear as mud.
there's that cricket sound.
I have a question. What are the chances if Kamala Harris gets elected that we get the final releases?
Well, no one has asked her that question. I would not be particularly optimistic. She's part of the administration that postponed the records illegally. So I think there is a person that's been identified as who would be her national security advisor. Someone should, hopefully somebody will ask her that question during the 100 days that are remaining in the campaign. But I would not be, Kamala Harris was a real cop when she was the attorney general in California and the DA in San Francisco. So I don't know if she would be particularly receptive to this issue. We thought that Biden would have been because Biden voted for the law, but it's my personal opinion, based on my lawsuit with the National Archives and just based on how we know he's been the last couple of years, that I think the National Security Council made all the decisions with respect to the postponement. He simply signed a piece of paper. I think that was all done. He was just told sign here, and the decisions were made by the National Security Council. So that's a good question, Larry. And if you happen to go to a rally, maybe someone should write her campaign and ask for her to make a position on it.
Larry, how many people are in the National Security Council?
Oh, there's over 100 employees. I mean, the National Security Council, most of us think of it as the top people that make it up. There's the vice president, the president, and the heads of, the CIA and other, but it's the staff that make the decisions. And we know, for example, who was involved, who was the leading decision maker when Trump was president on the National Security Council. And we know who the person was that was sent the transparency plans in December of 22, but I believe that person is no longer there. So we know who the people that were on the staff of the National Security Council that were tasked with heading this project about the declassification of the JFK records. We know who they are, who they were, but they're staff. They make recommendations to the principals.
Well, Larry, let me ask you a question. Obviously, it's election year and things change. People get hired, fired, placed in different positions every 4 years. So what I'm curious about is, do you think that this is going to have an issue with going through with the case at hand? Is that going to cause any potential slowdowns or advancements when it comes to dealing with, new people in the different departments, different agencies? Or do you think that you'll still be pretty well on track of where the case is at and where it's headed to?
Well, so you're asking, so I guess it depends. Let me take a step back. So if there's a new administration, right now the transparency plans are in effect. And the transparency plans provide for certain events or circumstances to occur before there's a review of records. So somebody would have to make a decision outside of there being a lawsuit that we need to relook at this. So if, for example, we prevail at the Court of Appeals level and the Court of Appeals goes back to either issues an order or sends it back to the district court to reconsider the case, depending on when that happens, would a new administration be receptive to our arguments that the transparency plans, as they're currently written, don't comply with the law and need to be revised? That's possible. I just want you to be aware there was recently a report issued by the National – hold on a second. I'll tell you what the name of it is. National Coalition for History of History, they issued a report indicating that the National Declassification Center is got a 20-year backlog of reviewing records that are subject to mandatory declassification. And unless they get more staff and more resources, this 20-year backlog is going to be further exacerbated because of the continuing volume of electronic records being generated by the government. The executive order of Biden provided that the National Declassification Center would use the transparency plans when it comes time to review the records. But if they're already 20 years behind on current stuff, some of the records are due to be reviewed in 2 years, but most of them are going to be reviewed in the 2040s. If they get a 20-year lag, and they don't get any more resources, the final records are not going to be released until all of us are dead. That's the reality. So something has to change. And I'm going to actually put a reference to this report. And this report also indicated that the problem with the National Declassification Center is it has no ability to enforce the declassification. So for Biden to actually give the NDC to punt to them when they have no ability to overrule the CIA or Department of State or Department of Defense if they want to object to any further postponements, because the events that are in the transparency plans, the transparency plans don't say that upon that date or upon that circumstance or event, the record is released. But what the transparency plans say is when that event or circumstance occurs, there'll be a review. So the agency could clearly say, you know what, we still think this has to be postponed, and the NDC can do nothing about it. So this completely undercuts the law. And in fact, the president said his last order was the last act required under the statute. So that being said, here's some good news. There is some movement in Congress to some representatives are thinking about introducing a new bill, not the Schweikert bill, a new bill to revise the JFK Records Act. We're hoping that the recent assassination attempt will add some credence or at least bring this back to life, that this is a current issue that needs to be resolved. We're not, you know, there's limited amount of time that Congress is going to be in session, so we're not sure if this is going to be even get to the floor in time by November. It's possible that a new administration might, you know, next year be willing to help push this bill through, but there is some effort in Congress now. We've got the attention of some people, and when we're ready, we're going to ask you, the members here, to contact your representatives. In fact, David, I think we asked on the prior meeting if people could give you the names of their representatives and also get their emails, so that at some point we're going to unleash the dogs. We're going to want to get all of the people that you know, are on the Jeff Morley's podcast, on this podcast. We want to get all the people interested in this topic when the time is right to contact their Congress people and say, please support this bill.
Yeah, we were talking, for those that, you know, don't remember, or, I mean, it has been some time, and there are some people that will see this on Zoom that maybe missed one of our previous meetings, but Larry has designed a form letter that, you know, you can use for making contact with your congressman. And then if you can either email Larry or email me or put it in the chat log, you know, for your name, and also if you know your state legislation, your members of that, you can put it in the chat log. You can email us directly at prodigyfk@yahoo.com. we can forward that to Larry, or you can also send it directly to Larry and skip the middleman. So that way, you know, he knows who to send the information out to when it's time.
Now, just multiple steps. The first step is to get the names of the representatives that you guys, your representatives, we want to know how many representatives in the House of Representatives, how many people, how many of those representatives do we have constituents that are interested in this topic? Is it 100? Is it 200? Is it 50? So we want to first find out from all the people here, send us the name of your representative, so at least we'll know that, and you know, some of you are going to have the same representative, but we want to know how many representatives do we potentially have the opportunity to say, hey, this is important to your constituents. When we get that information, and then when the bill is ready to be introduced, we will then basically tell everybody who's contacted us, here's this form letter, send it to your congressperson. So the first step is to please either put in the chat or send David an email or send me an email, the name of your representative and your email address, so that we can then create, we have a spreadsheet, we're developing how many representatives do we have constituents for. And then when we're ready, when this thing is ready to be polled, then we can just send an email blast to everybody saying, okay, here's the form letter, put your name on it, send it out to your congressperson.
Yeah, and as you can see in the chat log already, like Ron put in there, his name, email information, and then the representative. That's what we're looking for.
Marianne says that she's a personal friend with Speaker Johnson. Well, that's interesting because we have a Schweikert bill right now that's a Republican bill. The people that we're working with in the House, Jeff Morley's leading this group, they're working with the Democrats. So, Marianne, if you can send me your email, I'll reach out to you on, by the side because we want to see maybe we can get something. If we can get something from both parties, that's going to obviously increase the chances of any action. Okay, David, I think I've taken up enough of your time.
Okay, well, I appreciate the update, Larry. I'm sure we all do. And then let's go ahead and we're going to switch gears from the law aspect here. But great work, Larry, and keep up the good work. I didn't see Pat in here with us today, but tell him I said hey, and definitely keep up the good work.
He's traveling.
Okay. Let's see who we're going to move on to next. Let's go ahead and Larry, I'm going to go ahead. Larry Rivera, I'm going to go let you take over and give us some updates on what's going on with your research.
Hey, Dave.
Go ahead, Casey.
Just before Larry Rivera gets on there, let me just say a couple words about Larry Schnapp and Larry, I'm assuming everything that you are doing is pro bono.
Yes.
Because I have no idea who would be paying you on this. But at the same time, I don't know how many attaboys or pats on the back that we can give you from our community and the resources that we have. But at the same time, Larry is keeping us afloat legally. And according to the law and according to procedures that he has to follow in order for us to at least get an opportunity to open these things back up and come up with some answers. And so from all of us, I'd like to say thank you very much for what you and your organization and the people who are working on this do on a daily basis. And I know it's a daily basis because I do research on a daily basis for the last 61 years, as you know. But at the same time, thank you. Thank you very much for what you do. And I hope everybody else understands that this is a legal part that we have to have. And we are fortunate enough to have people like Larry Schnapp.
I thank you. And I also want to give a shout out. You know, Bill Simpich is part of our team. Bill and I are co-counsel. We do a lot of the heavy lifting. And then Patrick, who's not here on the call, he provides us for assistance as well. So thank you for those kind words. It's a labor of love. And when we're done with this, we want to then turn to the Texas Court of Inquiry to try to get Lee Oswald's arrest for the killing of President Kennedy expunged. But we need to get hold of the daughters. And just as an aside, you know, when President Trump was the attempted assassination on him, you know, there was a lot of talk about Oswald. And to the point where Mark Zaid and Gerald Posner published a piece, I think it was in the Times, I may not be, basically trying, the argument was to try to ratchet down the political rhetoric, because in the past, political rhetoric has caused Oswald and James Earl Ray to kill people. And if you don't know your history, you draw the wrong lessons from it. And while the rhetoric was really bad in 1963 and 1968, that's not why those people were killed. But you can see that there are lessons being drawn. And even the other day, when they said that the shooter looked up how far away was Oswald from Kennedy, right?
No. How about this one, Larry? They would compare all this, not only like what you're saying, but all the circumstances, you know, are just incredible. They only bring this up, you know, now. It's outrageous. And imagine if Rowley had been shit-canned right after the assassination of JFK. In this case, it happens a week after. Come on. You know?
There's so much interesting stuff about, you know, you look at all the cell videos. What if we had that technology then, right? You know, and the ability when they saw it looks like it was the vapor trail of the bullet after it passed Trump. I mean, all these things that, anyway. So it's an opportune time. But thank you, Casey. It's a lot of hard work. I've been actually undergoing some health issues recently, so it's been even harder to keep this up. But things are okay now. But we're moving forward, and thank you. It's always good to know that people are recognizing what we're doing, because it is a labor of love. We're not getting paid for this. But okay, we can move away from the legal stuff, finally. It's a murky legal world.
Well, thank you, Larry. I do want to echo something that you said, and it involves what we've talked about in the past. And I know it's not – we're not Nostradamus here. We didn't make a prediction that this would happen, you know, to the former president about an assassination attempt, but the same aspect you look at it, we've said in the past, if all the people, you know, if the technology would have been there 61 years ago like we have today, more information has come out with, and I've noticed that it wasn't like back in 61 where you had the different agencies, you know, sucking up the footage and photographs. You know, luckily, without people being, you know, naive to the fact like they were in 63, the photographs, the cell phone videos are out there. So, you know, in that aspect, it really puts the pressure on, you know, the bureaucracy, the bureaucrats, the different agencies to answer for what took place, how things got, you know, allowed to happen. I think that, you know, when I made the comment that history echoes itself, it doesn't repeat, but it echoes. We saw an echo in that just a few weeks ago, and I can only imagine where we would be at today if we had the film footage and the citizens of the United States, you know, actually that were there and just going, I'm going to upload this to the different, you know, social media. Social media played a big part in exposing a lot of what has taken place, and we have a lot of armchair detectives out there.
Let's take a vote here. How many think this Crooks kid is just another patsy?
Well, you could do that in the chat. But the what you're saying, David, is the media does not have a monopoly on the news footage, on the footage.
Right.
They had, so we're still, you know, the Darnell film was still being held back by NBC, right? If this if this happened, if we had this technology in 63, there would be no ability to monopolize the key evidence because individual people, and people now will be posting individually. They're not going to give their cameras over to the government, believing that they're going to give it, get it back, and it, you know, trusting the government, right?
Well, I think we're actually living through a real life version of, you know, the movie Vantage Point. I don't know. We've talked about that in the past. If you've seen that movie, everybody witnessed something, the exact same thing, but they witnessed it from different angles.
Right, right.
They witnessed it from, you know, different locations. And the fact of having the film footage that we have now, and there's more that's getting released every day.
Right.
Unfortunately for us on the JFK side, we're having to go back to the, you know, to the footage and photographs we have from the past to look and see if there's other things we can that we can pick out of there. So,
and I want to add one thing, follow up on what Larry just said. People, and this is for the young people. Right? Think about, so you could hear the collective sigh of relief from all the media when people said this is a lone gunman, right? There was like a sense of relief on all the broadcast and cable networks. Oh, this is only a crazy man, single crazy man. It's not a conspiracy. And that's the same thing that happened in 1963. People wanted it to be a single gunman without a conspiracy. Much forget about implications of government involvement. They needed a simple answer that this is just a crazy individual and there's no grand conspiracy to disrupt our government.
Yeah, I think the next day, Casey and I spoke on the phone. I said, Casey, looks like we got another lone nutter.
Yeah, but there was a collective sigh of relief when they said this. There's no evidence. They still haven't unencrypted all his stuff, right? But they're out there saying, no evidence of a conspiracy.
Well, I noticed that, you know, and I talked to Casey, you know, that day and then a few days after that, and I've also spoke to Larry about it, Larry Rivera. It's almost where, you know, I have to say I shouldn't say I was shocked, but it's almost like I saw the media, and I'm not attacking them, I'm just saying I saw the media come out almost immediately. It's almost like they took it out of the playbook for JFK. What really shocked me was, you know, you immediately heard, oh, I heard three shots. It sounded like firecrackers. And I did step back and I said, you've got to be kidding me that we're living through this, you know, and they're making those assumptions. And they were making assumptions. And what I also noticed was, you know, we had a report come out and it was, you know, the FBI said, you know, we can't, I believe it was the FBI, we can't make any ID because there was no ID on the person, so we're going to have to go with DNA. And then, you know, power of social media had already named this individual before the press conference came out. And I'm sitting there going, okay, I just took a mass media communications class, you know, it was in my fall semester last year. And I'm looking at this aspect of what I've learned, what I've seen, and what I've been doing the last 35 years in this case. And I'm sitting there looking at it going, okay, they are literally taking this out of a playbook, you know, media-wise. They're taking this out because, you know, did we ever think this was ever going to happen again? Well, some say yes, some say no. But it echoed back to the fact of going, okay, we're hearing almost the same shit that we heard, you know, from the media, and also I think we're hearing a little bit more from the agencies, you know, because we're in a 24-hour news cycle compared to what we had in the 1960s with just, what, three channels. So it really does make you wonder. The one thing that, you know, I would like to say is, was it a tragic thing that happened? Yes, people lost their lives. People got hurt. I don't condone that. But I want to say that, you know, if nothing else, and I don't even want to say it's a positive effect, but what I want to say is this: we always talk about the younger generation going back to the 1960s, and especially start with the JFK assassination, know what happened in your past so you can understand what's going on in your future and what's going on in your time right now. Well, I think with the fact of what has taken place in their lifetime, in my lifetime, I didn't live through the Kennedy assassination. It happened, you know, a decade before me. But I think with the fact of them living through that now, there are some people I've talked to that's, you know, on the younger side, the Gen Xers, Gen Zers, and they are now questioning the fact, going, this is something you've been talking about, and it's happened before and it's happening again. And in a way it has, and in a way it's different from what we saw. Luckily, the outcome was better on the aspect of the candidate, but somebody still lost their life. Just this time it wasn't the presidential candidate, or the president himself. So I think if nothing else, we look at the fact that maybe the younger generation will pay attention and start researching this case to figure out the connection between it, only on the connection of the fact of going, I need to understand my history better, because this is what you old guys, you know, I'm included in that. This is what the old guys have been talking about, and holding meetings, conferences, get-togethers, writing books. I'm sure there's going to be books written about what just took place, you know, 3 weeks ago. So I look at the fact of we're living in a time of a vantage point, but it's a different generation living through this firsthand, and hopefully, like I say, this will be the spurred event to get them off their asses, get them paying attention, and getting them to learn their history.
Seems like the FBI doesn't have that much motivation here, knowing the fraught relationship, you know, with the ex-president, you know, and other things, you know, where the military, you know, so many enemies, you know, they really, you know, really don't care, you know, how this gets investigated. And look at how the head of the Secret Service reacted during those hearings a couple of days ago. You know, she's like, you know, so what, you know?
Well, I think it just shows you once again, it goes back to 64. You had people, the agents, first of all, the Secret Service, this was a major epic failure, just like it was in 63, right? I don't know whether, you know, the Secret Service in 63, did they tell the Dallas police to stand down? Was there a miscommunication? But how do you have a roof just like all the rooftops and upper windows in Dallas? How were they not reviewed and looked at? And how you have this one roof, there's so many parallels. And then you have this circling of the wagons. Nobody wants to give out. Didn't even the FBI director earlier this week, I know yesterday he said no, but earlier this week, wasn't he casting questions about whether Trump was even hit by a bullet?
That did come out where, right, you know, right. one minute you're getting the you know, the guessing, and that they were doing that the very first day.
They were
guessing the fact whether or not it was a bullet or whether it was shrapnel from the teleprompter.
Right.
And one thing we have to understand is, you know, granted, investigations are being done, you know, but unfortunately, we want the information right now. We want to make sure it's not a something that's, you know, swept under the rug or a cover-up, or, you know, stopping of the information coming
to
us.
Hey, David, you know what I found was hilarious? You know, his getaway vehicle was a bike that was parked under the tree.
Well, I think that we have to give it time. And I know that's not the thing people want to hear, but I think we do have to give it time in order for, one, more people that were there at the rally to continue releasing their information, their footage, their eyewitness accounts. I think with the fact of, you know, can we don't want to rush to judgment. We want to know, was there more people involved, or are we going to, you know, just have it be the lone gunman theory. I knew the moment they started mentioning, you know, first, middle, and last name of the shooter, I knew right then and there we were going, we were living through deja vu almost all over.
DNA.
And there's going to be a commission, right? We need to educate, we have to very carefully look at how this commission does its work.
That's the point I was going to raise. I thought they hadn't decided yet there was going to be one commission, that Congress wanted one, Senate wanted one. Has there been a decree from Biden that there'll be one body? Does anybody know?
There would have to be an agreement. So like when LBJ issued his executive order, that quelled the investigations by the House and the Senate. So, it's going to be interesting to see how this commission is designed and how, you know, we're going to have to let younger people know that they have to, they're going down the same road. So we have to make sure and stay on top of this. And because, you know, they're going to say, I'll give another blue ribbon commission like the 9/11 commission and like the Warren Commission.
Right. Yeah, I think the different commissions, it's all going to depend on, you know, who's on that commission.
Yeah.
We have to go back to the Warren Commission. We have to look at why were these people picked. Well, we need to also have the idea of why the people are going to be picked if there is a commission, if and when. We have to look at the aspect of, you know, who's investigating who and who's investigating what. I don't think that the public will stand for another, you know, I don't think the public would stand for a Warren Commission. I think they may more look at the idea of the HSCA. I'm kind of in hopes that they go for that idea of at least, you know, taking the time to look at everything and to give us all the details. But then again, with everything that depend on what you believe, what you're paying attention to, and where you're getting your news and information from and your sources, whether it's you know, John Q. Citizen on one of the social media platforms, or whether it is a legacy media outlet, who do you trust? Who do you believe? And where are they getting their sources from? I've noticed that most information that's come out recently, and especially right afterwards, legacy media, you know, the media outlets were getting their information from what was being posted on social media outlets. I think the fact of, you know, the photographs and the videos, they all paint a picture, but, you know, you can check out YouTube. I'm not going to mention any particular sites, because obviously I have not had time to vet them all, but I have been researching and reading them and viewing them. They're already putting timelines together. They're, you know, clipping footage and putting it together. It's kind of the same thing we've done with the JFK assassination research. They're putting the films together, the footage to find out where does this fit. What vantage point did you have to see what you saw? And then you look at what's coming out on legacy media, and they're pointing on their diagrams, their versions of a blender program of going, okay, this is the trajectories. This is, you know, what can happen from this point. I mean, hell, we even already have a second shooter on the water tower. I mean, this mirrors. If you haven't seen the film footage of the quote unquote, whether it's real or not, and that's one thing that I'm going to say works against us with the invention of AI, with the heavy use of that and, photoshopping, whether it's photographs or videos, that is going to be one of our hindrances in this, you know, investigation of what actually took place on that day. What are we going to know that's real and what's not real? We want to make sure that it's not hoaxes coming out, because that's not going to satisfy the public, and it's also not going to help getting that information out. You know, we want to know what the hell happens, why it happens, and who's involved with things that go on in our in our lives, whether
David,
it
is. David, is that why, is that the explanation for why that the man who was killed was pretty far away from the president?
Well, the
explanation for why, you know, how did he become such hit when he's 10, 20 feet away from the president?
Well, it wasn't 10, 20. It was 130 to 140 yards, which is a...
The man that was killed.
Oh, right. The man that was killed, yeah. He was right behind the bleachers. And that's the thing. I look at this going, okay, we have 8 shots, supposedly. That's what we've heard. We haven't seen a photograph like we did up in the 6-4 window of neatly placed, you know, shell casings, not cartridges, like the FBI came out and said. They said they found 8 cartridges. Well, a cartridge is, you know, an unspent round, but a shell casing is after that shell has already been spent. So I think, and that even came from the director of the FBI. I'm thinking, okay, you're in charge of the FBI and you're using the wrong terminology. It's upsetting. Yes. You want this to, you know, to be, and we're going to, you know, nitpick, you know, gnat shit out of pepper on this. That's what we do. It's what we've done for 61 years on JFK's assassination.
Hey, David,
but I think, yeah, go ahead, Case.
I was going to just make a comment that, on the day of the assassination attempt, I was watching probably about 4 or 5, maybe 6 different media outlets, and I certainly don't want to exonerate any of these media outlets, but one media outlet basically said, all right, we can't jump to conclusions on this. We need to let the Secret Service do their thing so that they can come back with a report. Now, here's my armchair quarterback thing that I said out loud. And my wife says, who in the hell are you talking to? I said, I'm talking to the people on TV. I said, yeah, let the Secret Service do their job so that they can cover it up for 5 to 10 to 15 years or whatever it is. And then when they actually have the opportunity to bring out this material, they're going to shred it. So I said, we're going to be in the same type situation. And I said, but this media outlet basically said, hey, let's give them the opportunity to do research on this and come up with an answer. So I'm not exonerating everybody, but God forbid armchair quarterbacks.
Well, I think that something else we need to look at is, luckily, there is enough – I don't say enough. There's a lot of film footage and photographs coming out. And we all understand how the internet works. Stuff gets taken down. It gets deleted, whether it's by the person that puts it up there or by a group that works for that website and decides that no longer needs to be, you know, online for, you know, for mass consumption. So if you're like me, if you find things online that, you know, you want to make sure that it doesn't disappear on you so you can take the time later to go back and look at this, make sure that you, and I won't say how, or, you know, I'm not promoting this, but I think the fact of it is things need to be archived. Footage needs to be archived. Cause this is not going to be something, I mean, even if you listen to, former Secret Service director, she was coming out saying 60 to 90 days before a report could be issued. FBI has said the same thing. So in that amount of time before those reports come out, shit can go missing, like what Casey just said, go missing, go shredded. Luckily, I don't think we've had and maybe it's not been long enough, I don't know, but we haven't had a list of, you know, eyewitnesses, you know, ending in, you know, different ways and no longer with us. But it's different than what we had in 63. I will say this, but it also mirrors a lot of what took place. And we will, you know, continue to look at the fact of how they're giving reports to us in the future, how they're investigating. You know, investigations, they are not done overnight. And if they were done overnight, then we would still be questioning the fact going, well, we got the information too soon. So what is going to be a good time of getting the information? It can't be too soon and it can't be too late. But what's that sweet spot going to be? We don't know yet. I want to go ahead and shift gears. Let me look here in my people in the room. I thought David Denton was with us. Let me look.
I am.
Ah, there you are, Dave.
Yeah.
All right. Let's go ahead and turn this over to David Denton, and he's going to talk about the November conference coming up, and then I will do a quick screen share and give some information on that as well. Go ahead, Dave.
Thank you. Well, it's that time again. It just seems like we're always planning, right, Dave and I? We're always
we don't just plan one time a year. We plan year round. It seems like.
Yeah, and obviously there's going to be multiple events in Dallas this year, of my understanding. I think Lancer and Kappa both are going to be doing events. We ultimately are probably going to be sharing some speakers. In fact, I know that from our list of speakers that we have. But, Dave and I always say we feel like we do as good a job as anybody in terms of production and organization. And last year was pretty outstanding, at least in our eyes, and what we had. Hopefully we can follow that up again this coming year. We had decent signups already so far. The dates are the typical dates, so we'll be starting Thursday afternoon, the 21st. And going through Saturday night, the 23rd. There might be some informal stuff on Sunday morning again, like we've had in the past. Our lineup is excellent, I think. I think we're pretty well, there's always an opportunity that somebody falls in our lap and that we didn't know about. But right now, I mean, our schedule looks really good. It's a little bit of a tighter schedule because we have to allow for, Friday afternoon, the Dealey Plaza ceremony is going to kind of take a chunk out of our conference day. We're actually going to have Dave and I talked about maybe getting a charter for folks to sign up for so they could go down to Dealey Plaza, on November 22nd during the midday period. We're going to have a little brunch for everybody before we leave on that day. And then
real quick, yeah. Dave. I am looking at trying to figure out how to, I know how to live stream from Dealey Plaza. It's, mm-hmm. logistically, it can be a fucking nightmare, but I'm going to try to, at least have the ceremony, live streamed on Zoom, as part of our Zoom audience, instead of just breaking off, if we can live stream that ceremony, then it may be the fact that having somebody at one of my assistants stay there at the hotel and run the Zoom portion from there while we're on location in Dealey, we will try to live stream. I'm not making a guarantee as of this moment, but it's something that's on the table for everybody.
That would be a good addition. It would probably, for our Zoom sign-up people, give them a little more feel for the weekend. No question about it. But as far as our lineup is concerned, who we have, of course, Larry, Casey are in the room, two of our great speakers we've had before, Brian Edwards, Dave Knight, the usual suspects, and myself. But we just made contact with Dick Russell, and Dick is going to be on board. We're excited about that. Doug Horn is going to be prominently featured that weekend as our keynote speaker, and Doug's saying that this is going to be his last hurrah. We'll see.
Real quick, I want to interject. Doug was... basically kind of in the aspect of, bowing out of speaking live in person. And we got him in Kansas City for the student symposium. And he even said it re-energized him into wanting to, get back out there on the circuit, so to speak, and talk. And one of the things that, we like to do, they're not always the easiest at our conferences, but having a panel discussion is always a welcome draw and a welcome gift to our attendees. And this year we're going to have a phenomenal speaker panel, and it's going to consist of medical. It's going to have Doug Horn, Mike Chesser, David Mantic. Am I missing anybody, Dave?
I think Doug's going to basically moderate between the other two. Yeah, I think that's correct. It will be those three guys that will be on up on the podium for that event. And then Doug's also going to do the keynote presentation and another presentation as well. So, yeah, but that should be a highlight, I think, of the event on Saturday afternoon, one of the highlights. And,
yeah, absolutely. I just wanted to throw that out there. I mean, that is a draw for wanting to come to our conference of having that medical panel. Yeah. I think that's going to be an incredible discussion. How much time did we book for that panel, Dave?
I think we're going to have two sessions, like 2 hours, so they can each kind of give a little bit of a presentation themselves and then have some interplay with it. The panel thing went really well last year, I think, with the Ricky White thing, and so we're excited about it. Another kind of exciting thing, one of the all-time great guys has been associated with us, Professor Mal Hyman from South Carolina, who has won is the Democratic nominee for Congress. He is running for Congress in South Carolina. He won his primary, and he's still planning on just showing up either way, whether he's officially a member of the United States Congress or not. We'll see. But Mal's running for Congress. He's also been a great professor. He's done some great research. I still think his book, Bury the Lead, The Media and the JFK Assassination, is one of the most important books ever written. You guys were talking about media treatment in currently with what's going on. I mean, that's a must-read book that Mal published about 5 years ago. I think he's going to be talking about some other things, too. He has some things about Secret Service in Dallas. It's a little bit different, intriguing. So Mal's going to be there, and we're excited about his opportunity. We've got Ed Tatro, who's always digging into something new and always excited to bring it, is a great speaker. He'll be there. Rick Russo, he will be there on Zoom, but Rick, you'd probably be the only Zoom guy we have. We're limiting Zoom, in terms of, but we felt like he's done some great research on the medical evidence over the years too. He'll be presenting. Bev Sadowski, who will be one of the experts around the country on the RFK assassination. Ryan Jones, terrific Civil Rights Museum on MLK. We'll have him. And, Dave and I are in discussions about, possibly having Dave come back and do a little more on Medgar Evers. He fits into that category of the six political assassinations of the 1960s, too, which is kind of our charge. So those are some terrific names. We encourage everybody to sign up. We've got some incentives to sign up early. We would recommend you guys go on the JFK Historical Group, and please register for the conference. Also, we have, if any of you are interested, we've already had several people do it. We depend greatly on if we're going to bring students, which we have the past few years, college students, they need financial support to help them get there, pay for the registration, plane tickets, and room. If you're interested in helping out the JFK Historical Group, there's a donation tab. You can join at different levels for 2024. And, Dave and I'll be honest with you, that anybody that donates for that, it only goes two places. It goes, one, to help college students come, or B, to help out a conference. We're not making any money. Probably never will. Just trying to avoid not losing any money. But we feel like we've got a chance to have a great conference this year, and hope some of you can join us either by Zoom or hopefully live. Should be a great event. Does anybody have any questions? I mean, I didn't cover, again, I didn't try to mention every single speaker, but I highlighted some people. I think we're covering the different topics from the 1960s.
Well, I do want to throw this out there. I don't see the schedule up on the website, but the schedule will be getting added to the websites.
Right. We need to do that. We have actually sent out a first draft schedule to our attendees and to our speakers, but you're right. I need to post that. Probably we'll do that on Monday.
And this coming up week, I'm out of school for at least 3 weeks before I start my next semester. So I'll be working on the website. The videos, obviously, we will have videos available for the previous conferences, in Dallas. But I want to throw out the fact that, you can visit the, ProdyJFK.com website, under events. You can also go to the JFK Historical, website, JFKHistorical.com, to find the information about, this event as well. And then, we will be, also discussing this each month that we have our journey meeting. So you want to sign up, and also what Dave was just talking about with early signups. One of the caveats, one of the bonuses of signing up early, if you did not get a copy of the 2022 Alny Conference, yes. Right. If you sign up early, then you will receive an email with a link to Google Drive where you can download those videos. You don't have to just watch them online. You'll actually download them, and they're yours to keep. You can put them on a flash drive, on your hard drive. You can burn them to a disk if you'd like. But that's also an incentive if you haven't received or purchased that previous conference. We had a lot of great speakers then. It was filmed live on location at David's College. That'll be an incentive.
Yeah, another one too, Dave, is that we're going to set up a during lunch on Saturday. We're going to have Doug Horn available for anybody that signs up by August, I believe, 15. We'll have an opportunity. We'll have a Q&A with Doug Horn during lunch on Saturday. So we're trying to get people motivated to get in, sign up early, give them some extra incentives.
Dave, I was going to reiterate the price of admission of seeing Doug Horn alone, just that is worth the price of admission. Okay. And, the information that he provides, he's very meticulous with his presentations. All right. And, last time at Kansas City, where we have established, the extensive airbrushing in the Z film. And I just want to give you guys a very slight tease that a lot of that is going to be shown between Doug and myself for presentations, And without going into details, I just so people know, Doug Horn is the star of this conference, and we want to keep him coming back.
And Larry, I want to point out that I reiterate what Larry Rivera said. That there's no doubt in my mind that Doug Horn is worth every penny about him coming in. But I also want to point out that J. Gary Shaw will be there. And that J. Gary Shaw probably won't be speaking, but he will be there selling the books that he just put out, he and Brian Edwards. But he'll be there, and the possibility of doing some side presentations in some of the rooms that are going to be available. But for the most part, I just want to mention that J. Gary Shaw will be there also.
Does anybody have any other questions about the event?
Well, I do want to point something out, Dave. I look at the fact of, as a conference, the conference is a product. We are making a product that's available to the attendees and to the research community. And I know that, you know, sometimes some individuals, you know, they will come to us and they're like, you know, why is it, you know, why does it cost this much or this much? Our conference, compared to the other, you know, two that are happening the exact same time ours is, our conference is actually, you know, extremely more, you know, affordable. We feel that you get a great bang for your buck. And also the fact of, you know, what caliber of speakers that we put on the in front of you to listen to in their presentations, and also for those of you that are just our Zoom participants, you are able to see, and I'm not trying to pat myself on the back here, but I have to admit I do a hell of a job when it comes to making sure that you can see the PowerPoints, the speakers, and the audio and video quality. It's better than what you're going to get at the other two conferences. But that doesn't mean that I want you to just be on Zoom. We want you in person. You know, you get one of the biggest things about conferences, not only do you get to see the presentations, and you get to meet the speakers themselves, the researchers, but it's also the fact of one of the best times that you're going to have at a conference, and sometimes where you get a lot of information that maybe wasn't given during a presentation, you get an opportunity to meet with that speaker on a not so formal level, like when we're having dinners or lunches, when we're having a drink at the bar. Our speakers make themselves available to the attendees. They understand you're there to see them, to get the information, and they make themselves available. That way they can answer questions and corroborate, you know, and collaborate with you as the attendee. So, you know, this is something that, you know, you're not going to get, you know, you there's some things you're not going to get on the Zoom portion. You're going to get the conference, yes. The the other times, you know, you don't get a chance to witness that. So it's important that if you want to, you know, take in the experience, support our organization, and do what we're doing so we can continue putting these on, we got to have people come in person to the event. So I'll throw it back to you, Dave.
I mean, I can't think of anything else on hand here that anybody might be interested in knowing about. But please check our website periodically. We'll have updates. We put out constant updates on social media and our email list about what's going on. And we're on track for having a great conference. I'm real excited about it, and hopefully
can I make it. Sorry, Dave, the last 2 years were the first two conferences I was able to attend. I've been studying since 1980, but the speakers were all fantastic. And even your tour, Sunday morning, we went to Dealey Plaza, and we checked out the site on the overpass and just the discussions there. So it's just a wealth of knowledge and fun getting together with a group of people. So well worth the money.
Well, appreciate that, Rick.
That's the best advertisement we could get right there, Dave. There we go.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, that's the thing. We are.
There's Tom Chazik there too. I know Tom was there. He's coming back.
Yeah, we are I want to say a grassroots movement. I mean, we are not we're not a government organization. We are a group of researchers that, you know, are in the search for the truth, and to get the information to the masses, also get the information to the younger generation, especially college students. That was the reason why we have, the student symposium we put on this year, and having David's students come out from his college. You know, it's not cheap to, you know, bring a group of, you know, students out there. I know Casey can vouch for this. When we used to bring students from the Kansas City area, not only is it not cheap, but it's also a hell of a headache sometimes when you're dealing with the younger kids and curfew times. We won't go into that, but let's just say that we're doing the work that needs to be done, and we hope to see everybody in Dallas. And I know we're gonna have a hell of a conference. It's shaping up to be. Even though it's not an anniversary conference, it's shaping up to be a great conference. We're also, it just so happens that the 22nd falls on Friday.
Yeah.
You know, we'll be there in Dealey Plaza at the time. and you're not going to want to miss the opportunity to show up, whether it's in person or online. And again,
Go ahead, Larry. No, if you have a chance, maybe it would be proper for you to lead a minute of silence to two Giants that we lost recently, Phil Nelson, good friend, and Dr. Wecht. All right, whenever you want, but I'm ready for Blender.
All right, well, give me just a second, Larry. I'm going to make a – we're going to do that. And then, yeah, since we had last met, we have, like Larry just said, we've lost two of our key people in the research community. Phil Nelson was part of our conferences in the past. Known Phil since back when I was doing the Lancer days. And obviously Cyril Wecht, you know, I go back to the fond memories of, you know, and the passion that that man had, especially when it came to CE399. You know, he's one of the big names. Whether you saw him at one of our conferences on Forensic Files or, you know, the books that he had put out, not just about JFK, but about several different areas of study that he did. So, yeah, a moment of silence for Phil and Cyril is a good idea, so we'll do that right now. They may be gone, but they are not forgotten. They are still, as long as we continue talking about them, as long as we continue to going back and looking to research that they have done, they will always be in our hearts and our minds and part of our community. So eventually we'll see them on the other side. I want to take and throw out a piece of information here real quick. You guys have been, and I know it's, granted, it wasn't my idea a few years ago to go back to college and earn a degree, but obviously that takes up a lot of my time. Also being a single father, I'm working on the, like I said earlier, I'm working on the videos for, our conferences last year and this year. But we have some, I don't want to say lost footage. It's not lost. I know where the hell it's been. I just haven't had time to work on it. And unfortunately, when it comes to Zoom only conferences, like we had back in the COVID days, back in 2020 and 2021, they are a real bitch to try to break apart and, you know, put out there. So what I am intending to do, I'm not putting a time frame on it other than that I'm hoping it will be sooner than later. I'm hoping I can maybe get it done here in the next month or two. We are going to be putting out the 2020 and 2021 COVID conferences. That's what we called them. Because we weren't allowed to meet in person. We had one scheduled in Kansas City. We actually wound up having to cancel. But the two that we did on Zoom for those 2 years are going to be released free of charge. They are going to be on the YouTube channel and on our website. So if you want to go back and look at some of the – and we had great presentations back then as well, but they've been, like I say, sitting there on the hard drive and – I want to get them out to the masses, so we're going to release those as a gift to the community at no extra cost. But if you, like I say, if you like what we're doing and you want us to keep putting out content, donations do help. They keep the lights on, the website up, and they take care of what we need to do to keep bringing content to you guys and to keep, like I say, to keep it afloat. So you can always go to the projectjfk.com homepage, click on the Help Our Cause and Donate button, and donate to us. With that, I am now I'm going to turn it over to Larry Rivera. He is going to share with us some updates he's been working on. And take it away, Larry.
Well, I'll tell you, my war on this is fought on many different battlefronts, you know, and Blender is a way that I relax, you know, and do other things, because modeling, you know, is such an involved application of the mind here. You're dealing with most basic thing in Blender, which is a vertex, which goes on to an edge, which goes on to a face. And every good modeler in Blender, I need screen sharing here. But any good modeler will tell you, you know, that a lot of patience, a lot of work. I've been working with Blender now for 10 years. And the times that I've shown my work here has always been stills, photos, you know, images, you know, without any animation. And in the past, I talked about the goal to animate the scene, the Dealey Plaza scene. And I've been doing so, and with a lot of encouragement from Casey and David. And you don't know how important it is that you guys are really backing this project, you know. And I think I'm going to show you guys some really, really interesting stuff here. I'm going to start here. Are you guys seeing this? Can you see this, David?
Yeah, I just turned on screen sharing, so you are good to go. We see your screen right now.
Okay, but I'm in Blender right now. Can you see this?
Yep, it's okay. The Queen Mary.
Okay, what do you see?
The Queen Mary on the screen.
There you go. Okay. This had been one of my pet projects for a long time. At the time, I wasn't that experienced in modeling, you know. And let me get this out of the way here. Okay, good. Minimize. So, in Blender, you know, it's an X, Y, and Z axis. Okay, so X is the red. Okay, Y is the green, and the vertical here is the blue. So, in algebra in high school, we always learn about graphing in X and Y, you know, but we never take it to the next level, which is the Z or the Z axis, which is the one that goes straight up and down. Okay. So I started modeling this some time ago, and right now what you see in here is in the material mode, okay, of the model, you know, how much has already gotten into here, into this model. And if I were to switch here to solid mode, you would be able to see now how this has been modeled, and by choosing the edit, going into edit mode here now, I can go ahead and change the model as I see fit. Now, I spoke before about reference images, okay? So, and how, what we do is, in order to model something, and you wouldn't believe what some people do modeling things, you know, in Blender, but this happens to be these are the only reference images that I found that I could use. Usually on the internet, you can find blueprints of every car imaginable, but not of the Queen Mary, which was a Cadillac 1956 four-door Fleetwood, which was obviously adapted, you know, for presidential use. Okay. Now, as I bring in the reference images and show you guys how this is done, which is actually just trace. You're tracing what the reference image is showing you. Now, as you can see, this color, this sort of like dark beige color of the upholstery of the interior, I got it from this image right here by using the eyedrop function, you know, in the materials section here, where you're able to apply materials, textures, and everything onto any face in Blender. So, in doing so, I also had a model of a Cadillac, which I borrowed a couple of the parts. For example, the bumper, both bumpers, you know, but everything else was modeled directly by myself. Oh, the tires, which I borrowed. But in essence here, what you're seeing is just about what this vehicle was about. I can go in here into the dash, for example, and give you this amount of detail here, okay? And what I showed you before And the object, when we go to object mode, okay, and you're going to notice that only one side is showing vertices. And that the reason for that is because I have applied what's called a mirror modifier. So that when I model on one side, all right, I get exactly the same action on the other side. Okay, I'll just show you real quick. See this? I'm pulling on this vertex, and it's having the same effect, but on the other side. That's why the first thing that Blender artists and modelers do is they apply a mirror modifier so that they don't have to go back and forth, okay? And the other thing is that you have to align your model to the grid, okay? The origin in every Blender scene is right here. This is called the cursor right here. And this is the middle of existence of the universe, of the Blender universe. So when you start modeling in Blender, you have to keep track of where your model is in space, okay? And that's done here. Location here where you see this, X, Y, and Z. And this is exactly, if I were to move here, okay, let's grab the actual model, okay? If I were to move the limo just by moving here, scrubbing is what this is called, okay? This shows me exactly the spot in the universe, in the Blender universe, where this model is located, all right? So once I'm able to establish that I'm working in the proper place, in the proper position, then everything else is pretty easy because now I'm able to, if I want to scale, let's just say I want to scale the whole limo and I'm looking from the top, okay, and let's say I just want to scale on the X axis, I would go X and then just scale it in. You see that? Let's say I want to scale it in the Y axis. I would go S and go here in the Y axis, okay? So that type of control is essential if you're going to be working, you know, in Blender the way that I've been doing this, you know, for so long here now. We've got the Harper Fragment and everything. Everybody knows how the success of the Harper Fragment at the conferences when people are actually able to touch it and feel it and hold it in their hands. It's quite quite an experience. Huh, Casey? So this is what I wanted to show you guys first, okay? And before going into the other, let's just get out of here. And I'm ready to go. So here we are in our Dealey Plaza scene, okay? Now this is where the action is, okay? Now, remember I spoke about cameras and all over the place? Let me just get the materials going here. And where every one of those triangles is a camera that I have set up in this composition. Let's wait for the material. Okay, here. So we got the materials here. This isn't the actual rendering, but it at least gives you an idea of the materials and, you know, how everything is. And, again, we see this here. All of these different cameras. And I'm going to show you guys the animation now. And one of the most important applications of this has to do with the blink rate of the limo. Okay? Now, if you look at the hues and the much more, as the limo is turning from Maine onto Houston, you can actually time the wigwag lights. David, I learned that one from you, and how they're going back and forth on the blink rate. Now, what I'm going to do, as
you know, for those of you that don't know, the wigwag lights that Larry's referring to, those are the two flashing lights that were in the front bumper. A lot of people have always referred to them as flashing lights, and but the actual terminology is wigwags. And the one thing that I'm going to interject here real quick, Larry, when we think of wigwag lights today, for those that were in law enforcement or have seen them on, you know, work vehicles when construction zones are happening, You don't always see the exact same formation, the exact same timing, but in 1963, the ones that were on the X100 were just a standard left-right wigwag. They weren't in a pulse formation.
Mm-hmm.
They were a standard left-right, left-right. That was the formation of it. But, yeah, they're called wigwag lights. Go ahead, Larry.
That's right. And what I have done here is I have programmed the wigwag lights to go back and forth to show us what the correct configuration and the correct transfer between one and the other should have been in the Z-fill. Not that we already know it's been heavily altered, you know, but this is more further confirmation, and it follows the work of Roy Schaefer. I'm going to show you Roy's original chart that he drew many, many years ago. By the way, Roy, I heard people are starting to go there with a Bell and Howell. Roy did the Bell and Howell thing of the Z film back in the late 60s, early 70s. Okay, so that's already been done. Now, notice how here at the bottom, you see this is 267. That's the frame that I have established for this composition, okay? The other thing that Blender, probably one of the most important things, is that you're not only in space in a universe, you're also in space in time and movement. And how it's done here in Blender is by frames. The normal, if you start a Blender, normally it's only 250 frames, okay? And whatever you're going to do, you know, you can increase the frames. I have set them at 600 here, okay? And you have 267. So if I go back to the first frame and I'm just going to hit the back, okay? Now I've got everybody there at the top of Elm Street, okay? See how everything moved? Okay? Because now they are at frame number one in this Dealey Plaza universe. Okay, you see that? Okay, so they're there at the top. Now, when I hit spacebar or play, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you Zapruder's perspective. And by the way, this is a wide-angle view, okay? But it is Zapruder's perspective, and the camera, Zapruder's camera, has been programmed to follow the limo. Okay, so let's just go ahead and play that a little bit here, and let's do away with the gizmos. Now, notice the blink going back and forth, okay? Notice the flags that are moving, because we have already programmed that. See, one thing, this might slow down a little bit, but, you know. Okay, you got the flags, and you got the wigwags, left and right, right and left. See the two black women here? They're following the limo. You know, and those are called keyframes. I have keyframed the movements of several of the models. That's why, and I was explaining to David and everybody else, when you work in a scene as complex as this, you got to have a very powerful computer. I just have a Lenovo, you know, what do they call this? But I have a GeForce GTX, so it's everything is being processed by the GPU in the machine. So what I want to do is show you guys here how these lights would normally blink back and forth. Okay. Oh, and by the way, I also have JFK moving a little bit there. You'll see him there. Okay. And those are that I have keyframed some of the movements here. It's a complex operation because you got to do it with every one of the components, you know, every one of the models. Now, notice how the Stemmons Freeway sign gets here in the middle, right? Okay. So let's hide it. So, and guess what? We got this scumbag here and these two guys here, and he's pumping an umbrella. Okay. And as you can see, that action is going on. Let me, okay. And everybody thought that the Cuban was pumping his fist. Nothing of the sort. I've seen the ultra clear version of this, and he's actually waving back and forth, you know, and that's definitely a sign, you know, and that's what we see there, okay? And we've got that guy, but notice the lights that continue, okay, in a rhythmic fashion back and forth, okay, the way that they should be. You got this? All right. So why is this important? Let me run this back to the top. Okay. I can go ahead and oops. Okay.
I think one of the things I want to say here real quick, Larry, is especially since you're concentrating on the lights, by putting the lights in motion, we've looked at the Zephyr film for so many years going, this is the timing sequence. This is our timeline that we have to follow when certain things happen. Well, when you look at the model that you've done, you know, compared to what we saw back in the days of, you know, Nova's PBS shows and, you know, stick figure, mesh only formations of models, this is a three-dimensional model that is showing, you know, more than what we've ever seen before. And lighting up the wigwags on the right formation, if you put that into the different frames, it basically sets the, when you're making a particular frame in Blender, and, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but if you're making a particular frame in Blender compared to what we see in the Z film, you can match up the wigwag light, which one is on left or right, and make sure that shows in the Blender universe to show the right frame of the Z film. Is that correct, Larry?
One moment, please. Yeah. Okay. You guys got this here? Can you see this? The red dots here?
Got it.
Okay. This is Roy's original blink rate chart. Okay. He actually went and looked at each and every frame, and he traced and he plotted, you know, in what frame was the light on the left or on the light or on the right. As you can see there, it's all over the place. And this area here from 183 on, 882 on, this is the area where it's behind the Stemmons Freeway sign. So this is what we get with Blender. What we don't have with the extant Z film. Okay. So I just wanted to throw that one up there, and that's about it.
Hey, Larry, this is Casey. I just want to ask a question here. The wigwag rate that you place put in Blender is based upon the wigwag rate of the vehicle.
Much more in the hues. It should be the much more in the hues. Yes, yes. It's possible, however, I have so many objects now in the scene that it's slowing down, and it's not yet, you know, until I get a more powerful computer, it's not allowing me to set that exact rate. And I do have the mathematical equation figured out from the much more and the hues, the way it should be all the way through the Z film, you know, as it is in those two films. Yeah, that's a great question.
And then on top of that, can you give us what that rate is? Is it like one?
Yeah. Hold on. I got it right here. Sure. Just bear with me here, and I'll show you what. One moment, please. Ya estoy terminando.
Well, I think while you're pulling that up, Larry, I think with the fact of the, you know, what we've been wanting is to have motion, not just have still shots. And Larry has now put the vehicles in motion, so we're able to see more than, you know, what our mind showed us compared to what we actually have in the model now. It's progressing. Is it done by any means? No. But he's still, you know, this is a daily task for him to add more detail. He even went back and added in, you know, trunk handles now on the limousine. So go ahead, Larry.
Yeah, here's the math, Casey, at 18.3, okay, and calculating the limousine blink rate based on the hues and the much more, hues left blink light flashes approximately every 1.2 seconds, and the much more exactly the same. Right. So those are two very good controls, you know, for this. And what this means is that at 0.62 seconds intervals per blink and 0.35 seconds during the duration of the blink, we can calculate the frames per second in the Z film, that, and more importantly, pinpoint where there have been removal of frames. Okay, yep. So that answers your question, right?
Yeah, absolutely, and that's where I was going with the idea that when you use that application to the known films that we actually have in our possession, you can actually see that these films have been altered because of the mathematics that you have done.
Yeah, and just on the blink rate alone, you know, that's proof right there. Yeah.
I mean, with our, you know, going back and looking at the evidence from, you know, from the early days of you know, the information that we have, the, you know, looking at the testimony, looking at the films, the photographs, this is, you know, you get asked questions, why would you be doing this? Well, by doing the Blender model, by, you know, bringing in a 3D model of the Harper fragment that we used to just have in a 2D photograph, the reason why we do this is to bring the technology we have today to help explain the past. It's not to rewrite. It's not to alter history. It's the fact of bringing this information, putting it into the technology that we have in order to get the information that we don't have anymore or what we were not told. It's the fact of being able to take the Blender model. It's just like, you know, if you listen to the testimony that, you know, a motorcycle cop said this happened, or some other person said, well, I saw this happen. But when you look at the films and you don't see that, okay, you have to look at a few options. You have to look at the fact, did the eyewitness see what they said they saw? Do eyewitnesses hear what they thought that they heard? When we look at the, you know, when we look at the images and the video files, or the films, most of us are in agreement there's been alterations made. And you can be decide on what side of the fence you're on. Are you saying that there was, you know, alterations and adulterations made, or was there not any done? Well, in order to help dissect that down and to come up with the proper answer, the use of having Blender is a great way to look at. I mean, we've looked at the fact of, like I say, I mentioned PBS's Nova and Discovery, History Channel. They all use models, or they have at one time or another, they've used models to try to help explain trajectories or to, you know, back up one side of the case or the other side. This is a fact of taking this into the next generation, but it's this generation right now and this technology that we have. And Larry's done a phenomenal job and continues to work on the model itself, because is it ever going to be done? Well, eventually we're going to be able to put everything in there that we possibly can, but it takes time. It takes computer power.
Yeah.
I can tell you, when you're looking at stressing a GPU and a CPU out for animation like that is, and Blender is an intensive program when it comes to using resources of a computer.
The other thing, Blender has a lot of different areas, you know, where it excels. It's a game engine. It's a great video editor. You know, I don't know if you had a chance. You know, you put the video.
I have been playing with that. Yeah.
Yeah, and I was able to put together the Z film with some new frames using Blender. You know, and where I can pinpoint 18.3. frames per second and let it play out with the frames that we have. And don't forget that a lot of frames now, this is proof that a lot of frames were removed. And it just so happens that I received a late email, early email in the morning from Peter, and he knows who I'm talking about, regarding a possible piece of the Harper fragment or skull fragment that is seen in, I believe, 286, 288, 289 in that sequence, where now this could indicate a composition where the background and what, you know, we know happened, and the foreground are at odds, you know, and do not express exactly what happens in 313. Okay, and I'm looking into that, Peter, but, you know, give me a chance.
Well, it goes back to when I talked about, you know, plating. For those that, you know, have heard me before, I'll give a quick deal. If you're gonna alter a film like the Z film, you can use what's known as called plating. You're gonna have the foreground, you're gonna have the background, you're gonna have your track, your main track.
Mm-hmm.
And when you plate something, you look at this of three different plates. You're gonna have, you know, and how you match those plates up, that's the technical term, it's called plating. but how you match those plates up and then you take a photograph of that image, you can have it be completely out of sequence. I mean, what should be happening in all three of those formations, background, foreground, and the middle, you know, track, they should all be the exact same. And we've looked at it going, okay, what is going on in the background doesn't match the foreground. Sometimes the foreground completely disappears, and then you're left with just the main track and the background. Well, why was that foreground taken away? So, you know, like I say, it's very interesting. It's educational, and it's something that needed to be done. And up until Larry started this, nobody had done on the level he's done it on. Nobody has done what he's done. And I encourage him on a weekly basis when we talk. You know, I always ask him, hey, what have you gotten done with Blender? You know, and when he sends me little snippets through email or through messaging, it's always fascinating to see more detail he's put in. So, hell of a job, Larry.
Yeah, I got something. Let me go back to the screen just show you these two scumbags here.
And Larry, while you're doing that, let me point out to people in the past programs that we've had, they were asking the question and insinuating that what you were doing was just cartoons. This is modern technology, and I know my terminology is not up to date, but this is the technology that we have access to right now, and we're applying it to these films. And Larry is doing one hell of a job doing this.
You guys see this here? Two friends there.
Yeah.
Umbrella Man and the Cuban who we have identified as Bosch, Orlando Bosch, the crazy doctor from Cuba who wanted to, you know, take out Fidel Castro at any cost, you know, and ended up bombing Cubana Airlines flight out of Caracas, you know, killing, 170 some people, you know, that's this guy right here. So, that's, and again, the advantage is being able to put so many cameras in different areas and see the perspectives. You know, I think that's one of the most important achievements here.
Well, I think we'll go back to the term vantage point, the title of the movie. What you're doing in Blender is kind of what we didn't have the technology back. Well, let's say technology. We had, you know, photographs and films being shot that we no longer have because they were confiscated, destroyed, locked up, shredded, whatever the case you want to, whatever terminology you want to use for it. But by going into Blender and putting the cameras at different angles and being able to see from different locations, different perspectives, it kind of goes back to what we have with what just happened with the attempted assassination. You know, we have, you know, film footage and we have different vantage points to look at because those films have not been, you know, sucked up by the alphabet agencies.
And we got to make them up. And let me just give you a quick sample here. I got this guy here, right? And this is he's in pose mode. All these circles, these are actual, how do I call it, switches that I can manipulate on. For example, this is the clavicle, this is the neck, okay, body parts that I can move and keyframe. The most important thing here is the keyframe. You see these diamonds at the bottom here?
Yeah.
Okay, each one has a different keyframe, so when I had this set to 1,000 frames, okay, I had I discovered that I had to move these a little bit to adjust them, you know. So actually, this is him bringing down his arm, you know, after waving and everything. And then there's another one here. I believe this might be the clavicle, and we need to also adjust. Okay, here we go. This is the upper arm. I'm gonna get the upper arm here. And I've got these keyframes out of order. So you see that? So as I move the keyframes, I'm moving the different parts of his body, okay? And here, so as I scrub back, okay, and come back and let it play on, okay, this is what I'm getting, all right? And I'm able to set the movement of my model, okay, in any way that I want. Okay, so yeah, this is very time consuming, David, you know, but you know, it works, and it's a way of showing a different and alternative, you know, of what happened. In fact, I think our version is a lot better, more consistent. The next thing that needs to be done here is obviously the limo stop. What happens after the limo stop, all the agents coming out of the Queen Mary and Jackson running up the knoll, et cetera, et cetera. You know, so that's the next.
Well, I think this can definitely be a teaching model for the younger generation, because we can tell them, we can show them a film, we can show them a photograph, and then read to them or have them read the testimony of the eyewitnesses, or, you know, what they had said that happened, or what they did.
Absolutely. And Blender Nation is composed mostly of the Generation Z and millennials.
Right. But when you can actually show them in a 3D model, at that point you can, you know, you can actually show them instead of just trying to tell them about it.
Larry, I have a question for you. Can you show the viewer, the Babushka lady, what she saw? Do you have her program into it?
Babushka?
Yeah.
Yeah, I have 80 cameras in the composition. I can go to anywhere. I've got cameras even in the toilets. Just kidding.
A lot of people think maybe it was her film, not Mormon, of the picture based on the Tanya.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can you share that, or is it?
Sure, I just turned off, but I'll be more than happy to get it going again. It's
yeah, Larry, let me point out while you're pulling that up that 35 years ago I was teaching a course and I was showing the Zapruder film as we know it back then, and one of my students, a fifth grade student, and I may have said this before online, but he says, okay, he says, you've just showed us the Zapruder film, and he says, then you showed us the Nix film, and he says, you pointed out that there are several frames missing. Now, that was 35 years ago. With my untrained eye, I said, this is what we're seeing here. So he says, I wonder if it's possible to be able to take the Zapruder film and the Nix film, and the Nix film is, he thought, basically was intact, but it's not intact.
No.
He said, also, take those particular frames and reverse those and put them in the Zapruder film. And I looked at him and I said, who are you? And, of course, the kids who were there had no idea what he was talking about. And I just said, wow, he is way – that question is way ahead of himself. But it's now coming into our arena through this technological advancement in this area. And you're doing this just for us.
And I just put up what Rick Lucarelli wanted, and the one here that I have here, this is in yellow, this is Babushka, and I'm going to go ahead and give you that perspective, all right? So that's what her perspective is, okay? And then I'm going to go to Mormon, because Mormon was in the streets, and I'll give you her perspective, okay? Obviously, let me get these guys out of here. There you go. Okay? So hers, remember that we see some part of the cops there. Now, again, these models are following certain paths, okay? And obviously it's not perfect, but this is what her view would have been, and versus Babushka, okay, right here, okay? So, yeah, to answer Rick's question, but see, now I can go and I can go here into the storm drain here and give you you know, that view. How about that? You know, as it's coming towards you. You know? Now, how easy a shot would that have been? Hello? So you know, just having fun, Casey.
I know, but you know, even you see, who was it? You mentioned that somebody back in the '60s and the '70s was already putting the lights together. I can't think of who you said it was.
Yeah, Roy.
Yeah, Roy. And at the same time, and I had talked to him at a conference, and
you know that Robert Groden used to send hecklers when he would speak to interrupt his presentations. Now, who would do something like that?
I don't know.
I heard recent that he was on a podcast trashing my work.
Well, I'll tell you what. If anybody would take the time to understand, try to understand what you're doing. Oh, my God. It's phenomenal. And not only is it phenomenal, but I do know that there were some people 20, 30, maybe even 40 years ago that were onto this but did not have the technology that we have now, and you're applying it to that use and showing us not necessarily 100%, but you're pretty darn close of showing us that the films have been altered, and that along with that alteration, now we have the stories that have been told for the last 61 years about the lies, the fraud that the United States government all the way down the line has performed and showed to us. And if anybody, I know, it's 61 years in, and I do research every day like you guys do, but my God, this is unbelievable. But thank you, Larry, for what you have done, and you hang in there, buddy.
Anybody who wants to really find out about Groden should just go and read Pig on a Leash in Dr. Fetzer's book, The Great Zapruder Film Hoax. And I mean, doesn't even go any further than that, you know. But now with the technology, now that we have the scans that we have, you know, you know, it's obvious when Douglas Horn looks at what I did in Kansas City in April, and he said, man, you know, I'm 100% with you on this airbrushing of the Z film. And he's almost 100% also on the second agent in the car, all right? And the shot from the storm drain, you know. And so that's where this is going, you know, based on the technology. Thanks to the technology, you know, they can't, like, you know, in the preface of my book, I said, look, my first book, look, you know, technology is catching up to the evidence, the photographic evidence that was altered and left behind, okay? Now, from here on, you know, they don't have to release anything, you know, for us to prove, you know, that the Z film and the Alchin 6 and everything, you know, has been altered.
Well, I think another thing I want to throw out there is not just the work on, you know, the model of Dealey Plaza, but also the model work that you did on bringing out the Harper fragment from a 2D photograph into an actual now. I took your model.
Cartoonish, isn't it?
Yeah, oh yeah, cartoonish. But I took your model and then, you know, took it off of the screen and brought it into the physical world of the Harper fragment that we showed down in Dallas, Texas last year. And when we had Doug Horn in Kansas City, you know, showing and like I say, you know, there's several, you know, there's Doug Horn, there's David Mantic, Mike Chester, several people that are involved in the medical research. And to see the Harper fragment and actually hold the model in your hand, the 3D printed model, and ask Doug point blank, are we, you know, what was his opinion on, you know, size, thickness, you know, the curvature of that
frame? Notice the deception where the 2D one dimensional images, the photographs. They never took a photo showing the thickness of the fragment, only from above, you know, both sides, you know. So they left us with nothing. We had to go to the medical records, you know, and the which tell us, you know, how thick the occipital parietal bone is in a human head. And that's where we were able to, you know, with you and I going back and forth to get that. I understand that you told me that it's within probably 1% of accuracy, you know, as far as the thickness.
Yeah, I went with the medical determinations of the thickness of the bone, and then took the digital caliper, and the first few models, you know, that were printed off were, I mean, they were one layer thick, paper thin.
Yeah, I remember.
But then
that.
You add the layers together when you're printing that. So I mean, it was a tedious aspect to get. I don't remember how many different models I went through when I printed it to get the right thickness. Because you would take and spend the 45 minutes to an hour to print one model, then as soon as you got done, you were able to pull it off the build plate and take the caliper and put it on there to see, okay, how much more thicker do I need to go? And you just want to keep adding layers until you finally get the model correct, in the 3D printing model correct, to get the right thickness. And, you know, what I showed, you know, to Doug Horn and to also other doctors, you know, as far as the thickness with the caliper gauge, and I said, this is what we've got, a model of, you know, a human skull at this age, male or female, it's male. How close am I? Do I need to add more thickness, take away? And we are right within 1%. And that's pretty damn good for, you know.
And you tell me if that's a game changer, yes or no. Of course it is, because there, that, you know, when I arrived, I think it was 1 a.m. in the room, and Casey is up, and he said, I got something for you. And he hands me this, and I went, oh, my God. Oh, my God. You know, finally. Just kidding. But, you know, that was quite a moment, you know, and I think we can build on that, because we got to find a way to get the other side, and we got to find a way to get the texture on it, too.
Well, you know, here's the other thing I wanted to point out is that, historically speaking, it's considered the Harper fragment. However, the technology, the in comparison with the research of individuals who said that Secret Service agents got out of the car, went and picked up bits and pieces of the president's head and threw it back into the limousine, and they took it from a little kid that was standing there.
Yeah.
Well, that Harper fragment may actually be the Joey Brehm fragment that was tossed back into the vehicle and then later on taken out and then replaced back in Dealey Plaza 117 feet in front of the car, to give you the idea that the occipital lobe, which Hume basically said was parietal, and that's a complete lie. And we now know that's a lie, but at the same time, it's not parietal, it's the occipital. So how the hell did an occipital bone in the back of the president's head get 117 feet in front of the vehicle, and Harper frowned it the very next day on Saturday? But
after how many hours? 24, more than 24 hours, you know, they've already combed the entire infield, you know. Casey, you're being a very dramatic here and controversial, man. What's up?
God, I love it.
Well, another key thing was when we were in Dallas, and there are different thicknesses through the human skull, whether it's occipital,
right,
whether it's parietal.
That's right.
Luckily, nice thing of having a bald head, we were able to, and I even did this with Doug Horn by taking the fragment, and I gave it to Doug, and I said, put this on my head and tell me exactly where it came from. And he put it right where it needed to be.
And the curvature, the inner curvature fits exactly under the outer curvature of the head in that area. That's
right.
What's really amazing there.
Yeah, he actually, I joked with him. I said, well, I could get a little bit of, you know, super glue and just kind of wear it there for the weekend, you know, for people to look at. He goes, and he laughed, and we were chuckling. Of course, we were at a bar drinking, so what the hell does that tell you? But
oh, by the way, I believe somebody told me that you might have some of these on sale for the conference.
Yeah, we're gonna have them available at the Proud of JFK table, because a lot of people want them, and unfortunately, you know, they take a lot of time, and they also take a lot of material to make.
Even for
something just this small,
You
know, it's not that big, but just that alone, I mean, material costs. It's not to turn a profit. It's not to do that. What it is to do is to pay for the material costs.
Yeah, cover the.
So if you want one, they will. I'm gonna print, you know, a few of them up and have them there at the table if anybody wants to have, you know, a 3D model. Because the difference is seeing it in a photograph compared to holding it in your hand is the difference between, like, night and day.
Oh, shit, yeah. Shit, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right.
Well, Larry, we're going to go ahead and move on.
Yeah.
Brian, I'm going to bring Brian Edwards on.
Where's
Brian? Where are you at, Brian?
He was there. There he is.
Sorry, I was answering my 37th email about the Trump shooting, so.
I tried to call you.
Yeah. I just wanted to touch base with y'all and let you know about a not really a revelation, but something that Gary and I wanted to correct for those of you that bought Admitted Assassin. David, I'm going to share my screen now.
Go ahead.
You got it?
Nope, we're not seeing your screen. Okay, now we got it.
How's that? Sorry, my fault. This is the cover of Roscoe's scrapbook. We call it the mysterious green book or the dictation book or whatever it was that he had. He converted it into a scrapbook for newspaper clippings. And on page 9 of the book was these images. And the top picture, Gary believed that was a female impersonator by the name of Goodwin. And he went by the stage name of Mr. Harvey Lee. Well, we have found out that through just happenstance, we were able to find out that this is on page 191 of the book. And Harvey Goodwin was a female impersonator. There is him in drag. There he is without. And this is the picture from the book. And we thought, this is the same person. So Gary found this Club Mile My flyer with Mr. Harvey Lee. And so that's what's in the book. And we want to make sure that those of you who have read the book now know that the person is actually Doris Duke. She was a philanthropist. David, can you see the top of my screen? Okay. How's that? Can you see that all right?
Yeah, we can see that.
Okay. This is the actual clip from the scrapbook, and it's a 1941 press photo. This is the same photo of Doris Duke, and she was a socialite, an heir to the tobacco, Reynolds Company, tobacco company. She was a philanthropist, kind of a playgirl, but they called her the richest woman in the world at the time in the 1940s. Her father was the man, a benefactor of Duke University. To give you an idea, she's got a little bit of money in her pocket. But what we couldn't figure out is how did, if this is Doris Duke, that's the same picture, why would that picture be in Roscoe White's scrapbook? So Gary did some digging, I did some digging, and we found out that Doris Duke was married to this guy. His name is Rubirosa. His name is, I'll look for it here, Porfirio Rubirosa. And if you look him up in Wikipedia, you'll see that he was linked romantically to Doris Del Rio, Eartha Kitt, Marilyn Monroe, Ava Gardner, Rita Hayworth, Dorothy Dandridge, Joan Collins, Veronica Lake, Kim Novak, Judy Garland, Eva Perón. And he says during his marriage with Doris Duke, he was seen with Zsa Gabor. When she wouldn't marry Rubirosa, she divorced her husband and married Rubirosa, but then quickly divorced, and then Rubirosa married Barbara Hutton. This guy was a philanthropist. He was a sugar baby, basically. You know, he was the one going after the women because he had no income that we could figure out, but he was gravitating towards these rich socialites. And according to Wikipedia, they named him the Dominican man who inspired Agent 007. He was an ambassador to the United States from the Dominican Republic, a playboy, a polo player, soldier of fortune, actually, alleged assassin, and a race car driver.
Where was he from? Where was he from?
The Dominican Republic.
Oh, Dominican? Okay.
Yeah. And he married Doris Duke in 1947 and quickly divorced her a year later. But divorce decree, she gave him two airplanes, his own race car franchise, and, I mean, the guy was just a womanizer is what he was. Well, on July the 5th, 1965, that photograph on the left of his nice little Ferrari wrapped around a chestnut tree, he, at high speed, was leaving a all-night party, I guess, and blasted into this chestnut tree and killed him. Didn't kill him right then. He was alive when the ambulance arrived. He died on the way to the hospital. There's a real interest. I think that's the last slide I have of him. He had hobnob with Christine Onassis and Joe Kennedy. This is an FBI memo from June of 63 from the Chicago field office. It says he was talked of being an associate of Giancana's, whom he was planning to contact in France during June of 63 concerning gambling enterprises, presumably in the Dominican Republic, and Giancana himself was to meet Ruby Rosa. So is that a connection? Wyatt Roscoe would put him in his book or put her in his book? I'm not sure, but I find that Gary and I are just scratching our heads trying to figure out what's the connection besides just, you know, supposedly this guy's a womanizer. There's a real interesting book. Okay, Dave, I'm going to unshare. I'm going to keep sharing. There's a real interesting book that I just got. It's called The Last Playboy by Sean Levy. And on the back of it, it says the outnotes are, considered the greatest playboy of the 20th century, when Porfino Ruby Rosa smashed his car into a tree at the age of 56, he left behind a truly impressive career. And they list as diplomat, racing car driver, champion polo player, dictator's flunky. Now, apparently he was in love with the daughter of Trujillo, jewel thief, a killer, treasure hunter, nightclubber, drinker, lover of among hundreds of women, including Christine Onassis, Zsa Zsa Gabor, and Evita. He was a friend of Frank Sinatra and Joe Kennedy, and the husband of two of the richest women in the world, and his life was the epitome of the well-dressed hedonist that defied the 50s glamour. I'm about halfway through this book, and it reads like a true crime drama, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll kind of thing. But it's an interesting story about this guy, The Last Playboy by Sean Levy. It was published in that's interesting. There's no publication date on this. Huh.
Brian, all those attributes that you said about him.
Yeah.
That's a resume for President of the United States.
Hey. Probably. He's an interesting guy. Unfortunately, I love books that have pictures. There's no pictures in this book, but you can look him up on any, you know, Google search him, and he's all over the place, the womanizer. I mean, his list of women's conquests are, you know, there's 30 or 40 high-profile celebrity types that he was associated with. But he's an interesting guy, but maybe somebody can figure out a connection for us, but I don't know. We don't know what the connection might be, but anyway, that's all I had to say.
Hey, Brian, let me ask you, what's his first name again?
What's that?
Ruby Rosa, what's his first name again?
It is
Porfirio.
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 Yeah,
I knew that name sounded familiar. There's another book called Chasing Ruby. I read that a while back. It's called The Truth About Puerto Rico, Ruby Rosa, The Last... what the hell is it called here? Give me just a sec. The Last Playboy. That's another one you might want to check into. It's not cheap. It's like a $53 book.
What's it called?
It's called Chasing Ruby, The Truth About Porfirio Ruby Rosa and the Last Playboy.
Yeah.
But he also had a lot of connections and shared some women with Howard Hughes.
Yeah, right. I've read that in the book so far.
Yeah, I think they cut that part out in the Aviator movie with DiCaprio. But
yeah,
he had a lot of overlap and shared interest, especially women.
There's a movie. I'm looking up here. There's a movie about him. John Malkovich is in it. Not sure who else is in it, but it's an interesting profile of his life, supposedly. But you know, who knows how much of it is real, how much of it isn't.
Right. Anytime you deal with a Hollywood movie, unless it's a documentary, and even some of those, you run into taking certain liberties.
Yeah, you just type his name in a Google search, and hell, there's 25 movies about him.
Yeah, the last one came out in 2018.
Yeah, trying to find the one that John Malkovich is in. These are all in. Larry, you're going to have to help us out. They're most of these are in Spanish, so I don't know.
Sure, go ahead.
Just do a Google search on him, and you'll see all these movies. I mean, there's some actual film clips of him with these women. Some of them you recognize, some of them you don't. I just happened to end up on the part where the reason he was so attracted to women were so attractive to him because he was well endowed, I guess, and they have a nickname for him that I can't pronounce in Spanish, but Larry would be able to tell us that. But apparently that was the draw of Ruby Rosa.
Well, the 2018 film, there's only one character out of all the ones that were in that movie that was not based on a real person or was a real person. The rest of the entire cast are all real people. From what I've read on reviews of that, I haven't seen it, but from what I read on reviews, it's the closest to his story. It's the one that came out in 2018.
Well, the book is very interesting. It's an easy read, you gotta do like Casey does. You put a piece of notepaper next to you, write all these people down, because there's a handful of just important people that he hangs around, and maybe that's the connection between him and Roscoe. I don't know. We don't know yet. But anyway, that's all I got.
Speaking of the book, Brian, how are sales going?
Wonderful. We just got our monthly royalty check, and I'm going to be able to buy dinner next time I see everybody. It's doing good. We're going to have them available. Michael, our publisher, is going to have couple hundred at the conference this year, so if anybody wants to pick one up, we'll have them. I'm trying to get Ricky to come to not to our conference, but to go to Tampa with me for a presentation, and hopefully we can get him to sign a couple hundred books so we can get those out there for the folks.
Speaking of Ricky, have you talked to him and Gary yet so we can get the spotlight available?
Yeah, anytime you want to put it together, we're ready.
Okay, let me talk to you offline about it, but I'd like to do it. I'd like to do the, and I guess we're going to be doing this spotlight on a weekend, so probably a Saturday. We'll do it sometime between now and August 25th. Okay. So yeah, let me look in the if we can schedule things for the next 2 weeks. 2 weeks from today would be a great time. So check with Gary and check with Ricky.
Okay.
If we could do it 2 weeks from today, which would be August. Hold on just a second. Look at my calendar.
Hey, I got something interesting on Ruby Rosa. I want to read to you guys when you have a chance.
Check for August. Check for August 10th, Larry or Brian. August 10th or August 24th. Either one of those two dates would work out great for me.
Okay.
So get a hold of Ricky and Gary and see if we can do the spotlight here on Zoom.
Okay.
either the 10th or the 24th.
Here's the document from Mary Farrell dated 1961, June 8, 1961, and it says, with regard to Porfirio Ruiz Rosa mentioned above, we have previously received information from a source who has furnished reliable information in the past that Ruiz Rosa is an agent of the Dominican Military Intelligence Service, SIM, in a quote-unquote very special category. This was advised that whenever Ruby Rosa arrives in the Dominican Republic after having traveled abroad, he is given the quote-unquote red carpet treatment, and his specialty is to influence people in influential positions in foreign governments in a manner favorable to the Trujillo regime.
That's basically, that's almost exactly the format that this book is following. It portrays him as above the rest of us, that he has special treatment no matter where he goes.
You know, here's another connection. It may be a long connection on this, but you mentioned Ava Gardner, that he hung around Ava Gardner.
Yeah,
well, Ava Gardner
She was married to Frank Sinatra.
Yeah.
Well, that's true, but she stayed probably 2 to 3 weeks in a row in her home in Madrid, which was right next to Otto Skorzeny.
Yeah.
Okay. And so she would party with Otto and his wife, Elsie. So that was the Hollywood scene, the Hollywood group, but she was very much associated with our little friend, Otto Skorzeny.
Isn't that in Gainey's book?
I think it is.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for the update, Brian, and always great to talk to you and have the information shared. Now we are basically at the 3:30 p.m. mark. Everybody that I wanted to call on that were scheduled for today, I've done. So now we will open this up to our Okay. I've gotten some comments in the chat log. I'll say it again. I am working on the videos from the previous three conferences. So you've got Memphis 2023, Dallas 2023, and the student symposium at the college, my college, this year. Those videos are being worked on. I'm working on them daily, every day. That's basically all I'm doing right now until I go back to start my next semester. So I'm hoping that we will have Memphis and Dallas done by the end of August. I'm hoping the projected date is August 24th to have those two conferences done and then try to get the student symposium ones done within the next 2 to 3 weeks after that. So if all things work out correctly, sometime in September, all three will be completed. But as soon as they are done, they will be posted online. An email will go out to let everybody know that they are available. You can purchase those either one of three ways. You can get them at the conference. You can order them on online through an email on a flash drive, or you can purchase them directly as a download link, and then you can save them to your computer or save them onto your own flash drive. But they will be available they will be available here in the next, either, like I say, end of August or sometime middle of September. But as soon as they're done, they'll be available. So that should answer those questions. And now, like I say, we're going to turn it over. If you want to add something, if you have a question about something, or anything you've heard from the speakers today, now is the time to share and have our camaraderie going on. I know Ron had his hand up earlier. Ron, did you have a question?
Just piggybacking on Trump shooting initially, the media coverage was kind of shameful, just saying that he had fallen down. And, I mean, imagine when they shot JFK saying that he just happened to slump down. I'm not pro-Trump or anything. Trying to advocate for it, but I said the media coverage was pretty atrocious initially. They would not say attempted assassination, and I mean, it's just part of the deep kind of deep state that we're all trying to fight.
No, I can agree with you, Ron, on the fact that depending on, and I was flipping, you know, through the different, you know, legacy media channels, I call them, CNN, MSNBC, Fox News, you name it. And yeah, each one of them, I mean, I was getting more information off of social media platforms than, you know, what I was getting off the TV stations. And that's pretty sad when, you know, you're getting information before they're even getting it to put it out there. I do want to throw, I had something on my mind I just want to throw out there, and now for some reason I lost it. I will gain it back, but okay, anybody else wants to ask a question? What the hell was I going to say?
Well, David, I just want to make a comment, and that comment is that Project JFK, CSI Dallas, and the programs that we put out here, I would like to thank all of you guys for coming in to our journey meetings. And I know we don't have them that often, but we're working with a young man that's trying to get through college here, and we're going to get him with a couple sheepskins here, and he's going to go out and make millions of dollars and then donate it back to us. But anyway, I want to thank all you guys for getting online and paying attention to what's going on. Like Larry said, he does it for love. I think we are all doing it because I think we, at one time, most of us believed in the United States of America and the Constitution of the United States. And most of us were brought up with the idea that, that our government will tell us the truth. And we're finding out that that is, that's not the truth. And we're, and that's a slap in the face. And I know it was a slap in the face to my mom and dad when I first started doing research and bringing this material home. But I want to thank all you guys, for men and women alike, for coming online with us and paying attention. And I see Beverly over there, so Beverly, thank you for coming on. Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Casey. Okay, I remember what I want to talk about real quick. I want to go back to what David Denton had mentioned earlier. One of our group, Mal Hyman, he's been a speaker on Zoom, on our, you know, at our conferences, and Mal is running for Congress. So if you want to go to malhyman.com, you can find information out about him, find out, you know, what he's running on. And if you decide that, you know, you want to support Mal, and I mean, I know as a group, we support Mal and his endeavors, not just when he was doing research, but also, you know, him running for office. So if you want to donate to his, you know, to him and for his needs of getting financial support for running, please do so. You know, like I say, he's as they say, one of us. He is one of us, and I'm glad to see that he's taken the effort to run for office, and I think he can make a difference. So, like I say, if you aren't aware of it or you want to find more information out, definitely go to his website and you know, make a donation to him. I think we're going to try to have him on either a Zoom meeting or maybe a special engagement where he'll come on and be able to talk to everybody. I know he's pretty busy with you know, with different things he has to do, with obviously running for office, but he was with us for the student symposium. And, I think if I'm not mistaken, David said he was going to try to have him there, for Dallas this year too. But again, that depends on his scheduling. So, just want to throw that out there real quick. And I want to thank everybody for taking part in our journey meeting. Welcome back again. Sorry that summer. I will tell you, not only is it the fact of trying to come down from doing a conference, which we just did one in April, so May and June were, you know, I finished the conference and then went right back to summer semester, and they basically, summer semester is 16 weeks of college, shrunk down into just 8 weeks. So Luckily, I finished with another 4.0 semester in both those classes. But you kind of have to, as we've said in the past, you kind of have to look at, you know, what we all have time for. And when you're a busy person and you need to, worry about not only, you know, family-wise, especially being a single parent, but also the fact of, you know, you've got college, parenting, JFK, and just sometimes you just need that little mental shutdown for a change. It doesn't happen that often, but that was, scheduling the journey meetings, they're important, but they did not get scheduled the last 2 months just because I was extremely keyed into trying to pass the classes. So other than that, I want to throw it out there. If anybody wants to say something, you're more than welcome to unmute and join the conversation.
I want to say something, but you
go
know,
ahead, Larry.
Let everybody else. We've talked about this because recently one of our colleagues here, Mike, alerted me to this YouTube channel that had released the Mexico City tapes, the Mexico City tapes. They don't know which Mexico City tapes these are, but they had been released, I believe, one day prior, and I went in there, and I said, oh, my God, this is fantastic. So I listened. It's an hour and 20 minutes, and I went ahead and listened to the tape, and I said, man, this is important. So I went ahead and did a complete translation, and I posted links to Mary Farrell that talked about all the people that are mentioned in the tapes, because they are in Spanish, all right? Now, this site, first, you know, when I first started posting, I spent about maybe 3 hours doing this long post, and then I talked to Mike, and Mike went up there, you know, and he went in, and he also, he did put a like on it, because somebody in the comments below had mentioned my name as a possible person, you know, expert on Mexico City. So I said, okay, well, you know, let me listen to the tape. And the tape is a treasure trove of information, especially where they reiterate that both the Cuban and the Russian embassy and consulates were closed on Saturdays. And one of the main pieces of information, of documentation, which blames Lee Oswald and puts Lee Oswald in that position of trying to get into Cuba, you know, to go on to Russia and whatever, is supposedly on a tape that was recorded on a Saturday. Well, none of the sort. So the thing is that I went ahead and made this long, drawn-out comment, and as I decided, wait a minute, I need to edit this comment a little bit, you know, and improve it, boom, disappears. Comment disappears. I said, what? I went back. Whoever is running that YouTube channel thought that whatever I posted there was, I don't know, something that was not what they wanted. And they went ahead and they deleted my comment. I said, fine, okay, no problem. So I kept all this in my head, and I went ahead onto my blog, and I posted this article. And in this article, I found photos of all the people that are mentioned in the tapes and everything, and they talk about Sylvia Duran, you know. And so I went and posted this, just the link, all right? And I just posted the link, and, you know, and lo and behold, that gets deleted also. So whoever is running that YouTube channel is obviously, you know, not on the on the right side, you know. And they might look like they're, and it appears it's some kind of 14-year-old kid or whatever. But just so you'll know, you know, that I went ahead and translated, and there is one little portion of the tape where this guy calls for Sylvia Duran, and he's calling from Acapulco. And this is on a Saturday, mind you. And the tape supposedly is dated December the 1st. Okay, 1963, but it's not December the 1st, 1963. I went and checked the calendar, and it was not a Saturday. And to make a long story short, you know, you can go ahead on my blog and check out the entire, how I dealt with the entire situation. and I posted some snippets and the actual translation of what was going on in this hour and 20-minute tape. There's a total of 14 of them, okay? And one is missing, the first one. And the thing about this is that we need to pair these tapes with the transcripts that were released by the Warren Commission, if they exist. And the thing here about it is that this September 28th problem, you know, it's been documented. It was documented by the Warren Commission that Sylvia Duran had this conversation on the 28th, you know, and she was, and in this whole tape, it, they talk many times that she didn't work on Saturdays there. So just
Larry, I have a question for you. So I spoke to Jim Johnston, you know, and he, the reason I spoke to him, he was on the church committee. He wrote, he was one of the authors of Book Five, and I've been working with him. He's been trying to get material from Mexico. And I asked him if this kid's, I gave him the link and I asked him, is there anything new here? And he said, no.
You're talking about the tapes, the Mexico City tapes?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
So, just from your perspective, is this, are these tapes, these are tapes of the transcripts that were already in existence?
That's what I'm working on right now. I talk about it in my blog there. It's imperative that we pair, find transcripts that pertain to those tapes because they say that they're December the 1st, you know, on. Okay.
So, one of the issues that we discovered as part during the ARB process was that the ARB was trying, that we learned in the last big dump of records that we had an arrangement with Mexico where they would get dupes of all of our CIA tapes, you know, from our listening of the two state of the Mexican.
Right, the Leenvoy, the Leenvoy project.
Yeah. Yeah. And the ARB was never given access to those what Mexico has.
Don't forget that Mexican presidents were in on this operation.
Right, 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 right. But the ARB, so when the CIA said they destroyed their records, I mean their tapes, in theory the Mexican government still has those tapes. And so what these tapes represent, those are not, are these tapes allegedly that the CIA had taken?
Well, that's where I'm trying to find out about their provenance, because the comment on the YouTube channel is that these were provided by somebody who does not want to be named or identified. All right. So where does that lead us?
So why would a 14-year-old kid get access to these records?
I don't know. Another person mentioned in there is this guy named Morissette, Dennis Morissette. Thank you. No. Yeah, Dennis Morissette is mentioned in that, you know, on that site. And, yeah, I'd like to know where they came from, you know. But the main thing here is that we're getting information that, and we're getting a scenario that we didn't know existed before. Number one, on Saturdays, nothing that had to do with office work was done on Saturdays. And it's repeated time and time and time again. So when they tell you that September the 28th, Lee Oswald went to the consulate and had Sylvia Duran call the Russian embassy, that's false. It never happened, and it's falsified. And Bill Simpich has identified that September 28th portion that I just showed there as the smoking gun regarding to that. Okay, now – what I would like to do is, obviously, there's not very much cooperation from the other side when they are deleting my posts and they are censoring what I am providing. I did nothing. The only thing I said, hey, this is great, you know, let me translate them, you know. So you guys, because somebody said in one of the comments, oh, I wish I knew Spanish. Okay, well, here it is. I'm going to give you a full translation of everything on the tape, you know. And this is what they did. They deleted my comments. Okay, so, you know, what's going on there?
So this kid, has he been out there trying to get interviews? I mean, do you think he has?
David said something to me about him the other day. I don't know. I know his name is supposedly Alex.
Yeah, Pete MacGyver in the chat says his name is Alex Harris.
Okay.
And then I guess he's been researching this since he was 11. Now he's 14. So So this is important because I'm hearing from Jim Johnson there's nothing new here, and I guess what maybe if this is simply tapes, the Warren Commission had transcripts, and these are just the tapes of the transcripts, or is this new? Were these previously unknown tapes?
My point. I'd love to see the provenance, you know, of the tapes. They appear genuine. Trust me. I've checked out all the principals named in the tapes: Teresa Proenza, Rogelio Rodriguez, just as I named there in my all the people existed, and you can even find photos of them on Mary Farrell. So
when I go back to Jim Johnston now, what I should say to him is that the significance of these tapes is that they would suggest that the offices were not open on Saturday.
Absolutely.
And so that any reports
or transcript or anything that mentions Sylvia Duran and Lee Oswald interacting on a Saturday is false.
Okay. Okay. So
and I think this confirms Bill's work, because Bill is the one that found, you know, the September 28th, a Saturday, which was a Saturday. So all this is doing is confirming, you know, what he found out.
Now, I will tell you what Jim Johnston told me what he's looking for, because this is not what he was looking for. He said, but this is nothing new here. What he's looking for, he said that the Mexican government did its own Warren Commission.
I'm sure they did.
And that was what he's been trying to get access to, and he's been stonewalled so far.
Absolutely. That's why. Okay. Otherwise, why is Sylvia Duran so hard to find in Mexico, and she's still around? You know.
Okay.
Ron, did you want to add something? You're muted, Ron.
I put a screen protector on. I'll be right
back. Okay.
Hi. I saw that interview with Alex. He said that he would eventually release his sources because I believe he was on the Lone Gunman podcast, and they asked him about that with Big Bob, and he had mentioned that he would release his sources later on.
Yeah, I would like to know where he got the tapes from.
Yes.
So, Ron, do you mean he was on the Lone Gunman podcast? So are you suggesting that he supports the Lone Gunman theory?
I don't believe he I think it's a slap in the face. It's he doesn't believe in the Lone Gunman theory. It's a slap in the face. He's mocking the Lone Gunman podcast.
Oh, I see. And yeah. He went on there and he was basically telling you guys a bunch of bullshit.
Yeah.
Yeah, I believe that's just the title of the podcast itself.
Ah, okay.
Scott, you got your hand up. You want to add something?
Yeah, the title is ironic.
Oh.
Lone Gunman, yeah. But Alex Harris did an excellent presentation at Lancer last year, and he's really comes across as pretty amazing in his knowledge and what he's put into, you know, at such a young age. He specializes in trying to get rare materials and the original cameras and things like that. So he's definitely has a good future ahead of him in helping us out.
Okay. Good to know.
Anybody else like to add anything or have a question? All right. Well, I believe I'm going to go ahead and bring this meeting to a close. Again, I want to thank everybody that, you know, participated today and also took part in our discussion. Let me see if we've got a comment here in the comment section. Yes, Rick, I see a comment here from Peter. The Rick Russo talk about Bethesda, that was what we filmed in Dallas last year, and I will be having those videos. Those are the videos I'm working on right now. So as soon as I can, that was a it was a conversation between Rick and Ed Tatro. Rick was on Zoom. But, yeah, I plan on having those available with the – they're part of the Dallas conference, so those will be available hopefully by the end of next month. Any other questions? Comments? Quips? All right. Well, again, I'm David Knight with Pride of JFK CSI Dallas. This has been the Journey Meeting, July 27, 2024. And it was good to see everybody. We will see everybody next month. And as soon as I get the date for the Roundtable Spotlight Series with Ricky White, Gary Shaw, and Brian Edwards, I will be sending out an email, and there will be a post on our website with the determination of that. And then also look for another Journey Meeting happening. We'll try to get it done either the 10th or the 24th. So we may be doing a the way it looks, I'll be doing a spotlight next month and also a Journey Meeting. They'll just be 2 weeks apart from each other. So with that, everybody stay healthy, stay stay tuned, and we will talk to everybody later. Have a good rest of the weekend, everybody.
Bye-bye.